order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is March 11th. We have an agenda in front of us that has public hearings on three bills, Senate Bill 246, 256, and 248. We're going to start out by opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 246. Beth, would you tell us what's going on here? And I'll invite Senator Roblin up to kick us off.
Chair Edwards, committee members, Senate Bill 246 has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. The bill would create an on-site septic system loan program prioritizing loans to low and middle income applicants to repair, replace, or upgrade septic systems in order to improve public health and water quality.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and committee. For the record, my name is Arnie Roland, Senate District 5, which goes from the Charleston Bridge near Goose Bay to the 3rd Street in Tillamook and over to the cities of Sheridan and Fall City. And in that area, we have a number of failing septic systems. In communities that have been there for a long time, many of areas along lakes and streams, and so water quality has become an issue. And if you've watched the news over the last number of years, you have heard about the blue-green algae blooms in a number of the coastal lakes. And so I had been working with DEQ and talking to them for the last year or so about what kinds of things can we do to start having an impact on the health of those lakes and streams. We've had a number of elections and conversations in Lakeside, Oregon, about how do we improve the quality of the water in the lake and how do we start cutting down on these blue-green algae blooms. In that conversation, I also found out from people over in the Central Oregon region that they have groundwater problems, also attributable to, in part, issues with respect to failing septic systems. And so we know that there's about 30% of Oregonians rely on septic systems to deal with their household wastewater. And they estimate that 10 to 20% of those may be failing at this time. The resulting pollution, and in some places it's just not that they were failing, but that when they built the homes, the understanding of how the soil conditions and how when they're submerged half a year because the lake water comes up, the septic systems don't work effectively. We've got a lot of information now about how that goes. We have new systems that work in some of those places. But the reality is in some of my areas, the septic system replacement or fix is more expensive than the house the people are living in. And the reality is they don't have the resources, nor do they have the ability to go to a local bank and get a loan based on their income to replace or fix that system. We also have systems where the cities have grown out, and now there is availability of not only having a septic system, but hooking up to the sewer system in the city. And again, the resources necessary to do that system development charge and to make that connection are more expensive than the people have the ability to get the loans for to make it work. So they stay with a system that's oftentimes failing. What we're trying to do with this bill is to make a low-interest loan program available so that people can start making decisions and decisions they can afford. We'd also like to think about this whole system. Can it be a place where, like the system that we have for senior citizens with respect to putting off paying their income tax until after the death and the estate pays it. Can we do something like that for some of these systems? Are there other ways in which we can help people afford to get their systems fixed up and checked over time? And what we're saying here is we would love to put the policy in place and hopefully have a conversation in Ways and Means to come up with an amount of money. I'm saying what I would like to see is like a $4 million pilot project that is done over all the state, all these different places which we've shown have high problems with regard to either groundwater or lake water or stream, and make it a benefit for all Oregonians to help these people fix these things on very low-interest loans. And so the project, you have the bill in front of you, which kind of outlines how we would go about doing that. And I really appreciate the fact that DEQ has worked with me over the last 6 or 7 months to have a conversation and then to figure out how to come up with a bill, which the agency submitted, that I think has the opportunity to grow over the years. We can put more money into it, solve more of the problems that are happening around our coastal lakes, our groundwater in Central Oregon, and other places around the state. And I'm not saying that these are the only issues that are causing some of the problems in the lakes. I think there are, we have a lot of science that we need to do to figure that out. But we know that they are contributing to the problem. So with that, I would love to see us move this bill forward. And I'd answer any questions that you might have.
Great. Real quick question. What percent of, did 10 you say 30%?
30% 30% of Oregonians are using septic systems.
Okay.
10 to 20% of those are may be failing.
10 to 20% of the
30%.
Okay. Got it. Thanks.
Question?
Yes, please.
Senator Follow-up.
Someone else wants to go.
Senator Follow-up.
Senator Robel, I agree with you. We have an amazing or an immense problem. You're in my bailiwick now, which is kind of makes it easy.
Exactly.
We
love construction people who locally would make help our economy by fixing these.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, but let me just point out a statistic for you. In your county, you have 8,900 people on septic systems.
Yeah.
If 10% of those fail, that would be 890. A standard system. Just a standard, simple system is about $5,000 to put in. That'd be $444,000.
Very simple. Yes.
In my county, or in Multnomah County, they have 47,800
septic systems.
At 10% of those, you'd be looking at $23.9 million.
Right.
So the problem is you know, how do we fund it, and how do we get there? The other problem is that I would point out, and I would like to see this get done because we do have these problems, but a lot of times the geology doesn't allow for the old septic systems.
That's true.
And we have to go to the new ones, and the new ones are sand filter systems, which are about $20,000 to $25,000.
That's right.
So the question I would ask you then is, how do we get over that hump?
My feeling is there's two points to this, two answers to this question. First of all, I think we need to have a pilot program to show that we can start making an effect, and I'm saying in this low interest loan program, we're talking about $4 million or so dollars. It is just a drop in the bucket, but it takes our most needy, those people who really can't afford it, and gives them an opportunity to fix their systems. I hope that in that conversation, as things are going on, that people who can actually afford to do it themselves will choose to do that. As I talked about, the possibility of having a lien on property is another option. So you make the loan. You could possibly have a lien on the property. Most people who want to sell their property don't want that. As we did last session or the session before, we make this new agreement that realtors have to do to express, because we had a lot of problems in our area when people came in. When the toilet didn't work, they called the plumber, and the plumber said, well, you have a septic system, have you done? And they said, I have a what? And because they didn't even know they had a septic system. And they said, did you think the sewer came this far out into the country? Well, they didn't have that comprehension. And so now I think as we sell, people are starting to find that out. And many of them are making sure that those things get taken care of when they buy the house and fixing it up and doing things. So I think we've started a process, which even the realtors from my perspective say is working, at least notifying people so that they understand what the infrastructure of their home is. And some of them are taking care of that right now, and I assume we will continue to do that. This is trying to figure out how do we help those at the lowest end who aren't going to be able to do it, regardless of what we said. You need to fix your system. If we said you have to close it down, they'll close it down, but that doesn't mean they aren't going to go to the bathroom or something someplace. So, I mean, we've got to figure out a system to help those lowest, and that's what this system's about. I'm hoping as we get going and people see the multiplying effect of getting contractors in to fix it and start having conversations about what your ground soils are and those other kinds of stuff. So if we have to go to sand systems, they can. I mean, in some of the places on the lake, we have some people who've come in and are using the ones where it burns everything up. You know, that it's a they don't really have a wastewater product. They have a vapor product and some residue that's left over after it's burned. So, I mean, there are other options that are available.
Follow up, and then Senator Thompson.
The one concern I have, and to me this is huge, when you are on a septic field, you need to have a replacement area. Sometimes houses, as they are built around, your replacement area can't be met. And if that's the case, then they would shut that down and that house couldn't be used. Point one. Point two, you're not allowed to go in and do your own septic field. So the cost is going to be relevant to anyone that does it. So how would you overcome that in the fact that they are, one, first, that there wouldn't be an area for a replacement field, or two, if they had to do a $25,000 system?
That goes right back to the idea of why we need to have a pilot program, because we're going to find every one of those situations as we go through this pilot program. And you're going to get some of them are going to, the only answer is going to be a $25,000 system. And people are going to start to understand that. And this at least gives them a low-interest loan possibility of getting it fixed, even if they are very poor.
But what happens if they can't afford the $25,000? Then do they lose their home?
What would happen right now if we went in and then they did a check? I guess the issue is we're trying to make this a system that, because they come in to you ask for a loan, they don't instantly do a check on your house to make sure that they're going to close it down. So that's not part of the bill, is to say we want you to be able to go in there and offer the opportunity for it, figure out what it's going to cost. We're not asking you to be the agency that says you're shut down.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Yeah. Senator Rob, are they going to work through the county health departments or the folks at the county level that do the inspections? Is that the idea of the program?
My hope is that what we're going to do is identify those places around the state where this is really a problem, and that would take county help to figure out what some of those are, and then let people know clearly that there's this opportunity if they want to take advantage of this low-interest loan program, and then work together to get to solve the problem. And I think you have some DEQ people who can answer that question more clearly than I could.
Okay. And they'll be coming up next.
Go ahead, Chuck.
I'll wait for DEQ.
I have one question for Senator Rublin. I'm concerned because, like in Deschutes County, they have high water tables and stuff, and they're going to demand sand filters. Is there any way we can make it to preempt that? You know, a lot of times septic systems fail because they don't pump the tanks.
Right.
It's typically the main failure of a tank of a field.
Yep.
Is there a way to protect these people if the system is going out? That the county's not going to come in and
red tag their house. And I would say ask DEQ that question, because I think they would probably have a better answer. I will tell you that it's really interesting. You know, many of our family up in Washington have lived on in rural parts of the state where they have to have a septic system, and they found out that the mound they were on is an alluvial sand and gravel field from a glacier a long time ago. And they said, well, they checked ours, and it was kind of like we hoped your septic tanks were, because whatever goes out goes straight down. I mean, it's kind of like a perfect field. Their field never fills up. They also take care of it from time to time, which is another thing that I hope that people that come and want to live in these beautiful areas will understand when they get a septic system, that exactly what you said. If you really want it to last, it can last for a long, long time. But that means you have to do the right things along the way.
So. So you're looking for some sort of a safe harbor.
Safe harbor
for people.
And I think
to do
that's
right
something
thing.
to check with DEQ, because I think I understand that feeling. And when we were having this conversation, it was part of the conversation. We didn't want to put people at risk for asking the question.
Yeah.
And that's what was my concern, because if the county comes out and says, oh, by the way, it is failing, but you don't have a replacement area, then they're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Then they can't do anything.
Right.
It's like people who go out and think there's water everywhere in Coos County and buy the property, build the house, and keep drilling for wells and never find any water. I mean, you've only got so much land you can drill holes on, and the water isn't everywhere. We may think it is, but it's not everywhere. So.
Senator Denver, did you?
No.
Okay.
I'm good. Thanks.
No, thank questions?
You.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yep.
Right. Next, I'd like to call up Karen Tarno from the DEQ, and if you have any reinforcements or anybody else you'd like to come up with you from the DEQ, that would be, they'd be welcome at the same time.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk with you, and I'd also like to thank Senator Roblin for his support and encouragement around this bill. I didn't want to take a lot of your time today. I want to
just, for the record.
Name for the record is Karen Tarno, policy analyst from Department of Environmental Quality. Thank you. I won't take a lot of time. I just want to go very quickly over what the bill does, talk about some conversations that Senator Roblin, Representative McEwen, and a number of interested groups have been having lately, some amendments that we would like to put forward at a future meeting of this committee, And just a hint at some of the things we're learning from some very successful programs the state of Washington has been implementing for a number of years that provide some hope, I think, perhaps, for some ways that we might be able to do some creative financing to chew off a bigger part of this problem. So if I may, the bill is pretty simply written. It allows the EQC to adopt rules necessary to administer the program. It directs us to prioritize but not limit providing loans to low and moderate income applicants. The bill establishes an on-site septic system loan fund, which may receive appropriations from the legislature or grants or bequests from other private or public entities. And the monies from the fund can be used for a number of things. It can be used for DEQ's cost to administer the program. It can be used for repairing, replacing, or upgrading septic systems. And it also can be used to finance hookups to sewers, where that's the appropriate solution to instead of replacing or repairing a septic system. And I just want to state the obvious that we are coming forward with this bill to ask the legislature for the authority to establish the program. There is no money for this in the governor's budget, and we're looking to Senator Roblin and others like yourselves to have that discussion about whether or how to fund this program. So the bill is purposely written to be broad and to keep options open as to how this loan program could be implemented. The loan program could be implemented by DEQ, where we actually enter into loan agreements with homeowners, which is probably not our first choice of how to implement the program. It could be implemented by a local government, such as a county, or it could be implemented by a private or nonprofit entity. The concept, keeping it very broad, was endorsed by Senator Roblin and Representative McEwen and a half dozen or so stakeholders we met with last week, understanding that we'll have opportunity through rulemaking and other program development to narrow and to focus this. There's discussion around how do we prioritize where we put the money and such. And again, like I said, we didn't want to narrow our options at this point in time, but recognize that those conversations and issues needed to be sorted out. We did discuss and agree to a number of amendments and concepts, and I just want to take through those quickly for you so you know what's coming, what might be coming before you. First of all, we want to add the ability to use loan funds to provide grants for doing septic surveys. You know we have a lot of failing systems. We don't necessarily know which ones those are. And until we know which ones are failing and which ones need to be addressed, we may not have a lot of people coming to our door to use this loan program. So we've heard this from some of the counties, and certainly it's been an important part of the program in Washington, that to jumpstart this, having money available to do these septic surveys is an important aspect. We also want to add language to the bill to make loans eligible for systems that pose not just an environmental problem, but also pose a public health problem. We just wanted to make sure that the door was open across the board there, such as a system that's potentially a risk to drinking water. We wanted to add the opportunity to make loans available for small commercial establishments, such as a restaurant or an apartment. In some areas, these might actually be the very things that are causing a problem, and they may be as hard-strapped to find funding or traditional financing as well. So we, again, just wanted to keep the door open to those. We also... it's a little unpleasant, but we also wanted to make sure that when we provide a loan for a hookup, it's not just because we want to get off a septic system, but also there are instances, particularly in central Oregon, where homes use what's called a sewage drill hole to dispose of their waste, which is, essentially just a drill hole to drill into the lava fields and it's gone. So obviously where we can supplement, where we can get those on the sewage system, we'd like to accomplish that. And we would also add a report to the legislature in 15 and 16 so that we could keep you apprised of what's where we're going with this program and if we found any ways to improve it. And lastly, and this is a fine touch, the bill talks about loans being eligible for systems that are contributing to pollution. We want to change that language to instances where there will be a water quality benefit. We want to recognize that we want to address water quality problems, but we also want to prevent them. And so that's a little bit broader and, again, opens the door to a wider way of local priorities. Let's see. I guess I'll wrap up by saying that, as I mentioned, we have been talking with Washington, and Washington's had on-site loan programs in place in different parts of the state for over 20 years, and they've been very successful. They have, on the financing front, they have, in a couple instances, gotten some fairly big checks from some private foundations that have helped implement the program. They also have used some state grant monies, their Centennial Fund, to leverage the Clean Water State Revolving Fund loan monies, the program that we also run. And what we found, what they found, and it makes perfect sense to us, is that whereas we could go right now as DEQ and we could make a enter into a loan agreement with a county, and they could use that financing to set up and do their own local loan program, because we're dealing with the low interest or low income population and it's a little higher risk pool, and because of the administrative costs of doing that program, they need a little something more than just a loan to make this work, to make it pencil out. And so leveraging, using some state or private funding to leverage an SRF loan, has been a very successful model up there. Another aspect of their program that's been successful is sometimes the program's been implemented by counties themselves. Other times they've partnered with, say, a credit union or a lending organization that has actually implemented the program, those that have the expertise in loans and the systems already set up for it. So sometimes that's the most cost-effective way to go about the program. And that's all I have to offer today. I do hope you support the bill and might entertain some amendments if we come back here, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thanks, Karen. I had a real quick question. You said you wanted to change it so that it could, you mentioned water quality benefit language. What was the previous language that you want to broaden that for?
Right now it says contributing to pollution.
Okay, contributing. Okay. Okay. Okay, that's all my questions for the moment. Senator Olson?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, ma'am. On page 2, line 27 of the bill, you say that the loan origination and servicing and development of related programs. Could you explain what a related program would be?
Yes, Chair Edwards, Senator Olson. Related programs might be, let's see if it's mentioned in here. Well, actually, I was thinking of the marketing aspect of it. Working with the installer community, the septic system professionals, to educate them about the program. They're the face-to-face with the homeowners to get them to help be outreach on the program, let people know where they can find a solution. Right now, other than the ones that are listing there, nothing comes to mind.
Can you follow up?
Yeah, follow up.
What happens if you give a loan, and you're not a bank, but mm-hmm. if you give a loan and it's not repaid, what do you do?
Sure. Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, if there's a loan default, to be honest,
you'll be in second position, you know, because there'll be a mortgage on the house.
Sure. Sure. I think, I'd have to get back to you actually to answer the specifics of how that works. It does speak to the fact of, what they've found is important in Washington in their programs is to have some amount of money banked for a loan loss reserve. I think they generally target about 10% of the loans that are out there, just as a buffer against that, so that the program can absorb the loss if and when it occurs. They haven't experienced a lot, is what I've heard from them, but they given the population that we're mostly the working with, they've made that allowance.
Follow up. In the research that we've done, there's a lot of septic systems out there. There's a lot of them. So let me ask you a question along that line. Is it a fact that there's 10 to 20% failing, or is that just a guesstimate?
Yeah. Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, we have, there's a couple of areas in the state that have done local surveys and inspections, and that's a number that they've found. I actually believe in Senator Prozanski, perhaps in your area, in the McKenzie area, they found something along that in that range. From a couple of other places around the country, they've also corroborated that amount, but we do not have any kind, by far, any kind of a inventory statewide as to know whether the whole universe really fits within that.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Because when a septic tank fails, typically you know it, because the field doesn't work anymore and the tank overruns and stuff like that. How do you define failing? And you say it affects water quality. How have you ascertained that a system that might not be functioning quite at 100% is affecting water quality?
Sure. Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, as you mentioned, a lot of people know when it's failing. Other times they might not know if the discharge is actually running into a body of water. We might find that out through water quality data, and in the instance where we collect data, sometimes part of a septic survey might be to do a shoreline survey where you're actually collecting data along the shoreline to help find out where the hot spots are, and that's one way to trace it back to identify areas where there could potentially be failing systems. Groundwater problems is another way. If we see groundwater quality, that's poor water quality or if it's got bacteria nitrate problems, it's possible that the septic systems in that area just aren't functioning as they should.
Follow up, and then Senator Thompson, then Senator Prozanski.
Okay, along rivers, when you say failing, does that mean that the system, because typically the system lets water out into leach fields.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that those leach fields are allowing that water to flow directly into the river, so it's a direct discharge into the river? Or is it a system that is gathering in the water pool of the area and then matriculating over to the river? Is that,
sure.
Is that what you found, or do you have any information on that?
Yeah, Chair Edwards. Senator Ellison, I think I don't have any specific information. I think it could be either of those instances. I think it could also be systems that do not have a drain field, that simply have a pipe, or you know, really are not to code.
So then they're not failing. They're not systems.
Well, they're right. Exactly.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Thompson.
Yeah, I think if my memory is correct, I think we had this bill in 2011. 13.
Sir,
I've seen a septic tank bill of some sort before. I think it was. I think it was tied to fees, and that's probably
right.
Why I didn't get the support.
Right, Chair Edwards and Senator Thompson. There was a bill. It was a little different from this. It was looking at ways to generate revenue for the program that would enable us to do more of the work that's not paid for by fees,
mm-hmm.
like the outreach and education, like inspections, like enforcement activities.
Yeah.
And the like.
Follow up?
Yeah.
So I didn't see anything in here about fees. Is that in the works too? I didn't see it in the bill.
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, no. This is it's not really directly related to our on-site programs or and the revenue would not be tied to the implementation of those programs. And the fees that I think we're talking about, yes, if you do go in to repair or replace a septic system, there are permits required for that.
Yeah.
I know in the loan programs they're using in Washington, those kinds of fees are included in the loan. Some of their loan programs also include a certain amount for ongoing maintenance, so that after, you know, once you've got a good system, you keep it running well.
One more question.
Yeah.
You mentioned in the state of Washington, they some of these programs similar to this have received some grants from different groups. Has DEQ ever received grants? I mean, are you guys capable of handling those, or are you going to have to set up a whole system, or do you do some of those kind of things, like things?
Sure. Senator Edwards, Senator Thompson, we've talked about what kind of financial capacity we would need in our agency to manage things like the higher administrative. We do receive grants. We do have capacity for that. We do enter into contracts if we were contracting or providing a loan to a county or contracting with a third party to do the work. We do have infrastructure to do that and don't anticipate that creating a significant cost for our agency. There would be some administrative costs in the setting up of these, entering into the contracts with the entities that are actually going to implement it.
Mm-hmm.
But other than us taking the money that might go into the loan fund, no, I think we're set up to do that.
Okay. Thanks.
Senator Brzozowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess in kind of response to what we heard about the McKinsey, I've had the opportunity to be on the river in the upper parts where it is, call it unspoiled native, no development. And then as you get into the areas where there is housing, you can actually see where you have algae, fungi type of growth. And it has been attributed, I think, to both. Because you really, until you go in there and actually do some more on-site investigation, whether it's some type of leakage through a drain field that's then somehow getting in the groundwater and then coming into there, or if it's a broken system, I think it's a combination of both. And what I'm hearing for this bill compared to what was in 11 is that let's see if we can't find the money, go out and do more work and getting more information and insisting those who we know that have these problems before they get to the point of where you have decoration of the waters and stuff. And that's one of the things that mm-hmm. it's very obvious if you take one of these float trips and actually do it. EWEB has been one of the instrumentals of showing us how when you have that mix of civilization into these areas that it can in fact be detrimental to the river and its quality.
Mm-hmm. If I may, Senator Edwards, Senator Brzozowski, one of the, there may not be as much work going on as there could be to identify failing systems because there may not be a good solution for homeowners of those systems. And that speaks to the importance of getting a program like this in place so that we can really have a solution there for people who need it.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I'd like to just point out, I support something like this because we need to fix this stuff. My biggest concern is that we're going to get, because we're dealing particularly with low and low income, that we're getting to the fact that they won't be able to afford the high-end systems that it would take to repair their system. And so then it gets into what do? We know they have a failing system, but they can't afford to put a new one in. So how would we solve that?
Yes, sir.
I think this is back to the agency. There's a company out of the Roseburg, Sutherland area, Orenco,
mm-hmm.
and I'm wondering if y'all are familiar with them. They actually have these systems that they go in kind of a, I don't know if it's modular community where you can have kind of like a catch system for multiple houses that then can go in. And I know that they do stuff internationally. And it might be something that we might want to get a little bit more information on as to how that might be able to be utilized in these type of unique situations where your space is tight and you have already an existing housing development or, you know, whatever you want to call that, that if they're close enough, you might be able to tag into having a different system that could address that.
Good.
Thank you for answering questions and testifying on this bill. Next, I'm going to start calling up panels of three. Not necessarily, I mean, I know you didn't all sign up together, but just for the sake of expediency now that the bill's been explained. So we'll start with Bob Soden and Doug Riggs and Sean Cleave. And next up after that will be Tracy Rutten, Mark Landauer, and Peggy Lynch.
This is 248, sir?
Chair. No, we're on 246.
I'm on 248.
Okay, well then you can retreat. Tracy, why don't you come on up with these gentlemen, and then next up will be Mark Landauer, Peggy Lynch, and Ken Yates. Go ahead. Well, Doug signed up first, but I don't really care.
Beauty before age, Chair Edwards. Members of the committee.
Move over one.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing Oregon Association of Realtors. I'd like to thank Senator Roblin for introducing Senate Bill 246, to which we support. Big fans at OAR of the concept of a revolving fund. It's much more efficient than a point-of-sale mandate. The Association of Realtors has worked diligently with the members of the Assembly and DEQ over the years. Senator Roblin did mention the disclosure that we added to point of sale, which has had some impact on the issue. I absolutely appreciate Senator Olson's perspective on the issue. It is, for all accounts, a very large issue based on the number of septic systems. I think the bill as drafted contains a good starting point for narrowing in rule and identifying some priorities to where those opportunities may lie. And with that, I will close my testimony and answer any questions if the committee has any.
All right. Any questions? No questions. Doug.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization. I think you have in your packet a letter from the city of Lapine. Lapine has been engaged in the work group and certainly has great concerns about this ongoing issue. So I won't belabor Rick Allen's points, but let me make just three quick points. First of all, four with this point. I think Senator Roblin had a lot of the very good points about the importance in various parts of the state of doing this. It's different in each part of the state. This is designed to be flexible, so it meets those needs. But three quick points. First of all, I really view this as a public-private partnership. This is an opportunity for the state to step in and leverage the ability of a private homeowner to do the right thing for him or her and his home. I like to think of it as either you can pay me a little bit now or you can pay me a lot later, because gone untreated, unaddressed, this problem will just grow over time. The second thing kind of emphasizes the first point I made, which is we're talking about, in our area, a lot of low-income individuals and senior citizens who don't have the money to be able to do this on their own. And so we're, number one, helping them with their immediate need, but number two, we're helping them protect the value of their property and the value of their home long term, and I think that's important. And then the third thing I'd like to point out is that this committee has been working with us in Deschutes, the Deschutes Basin, for the better part of 15 years to come up with a system to enhance and protect the flows in the Deschutes River. And this is a problem that, left untreated, could affect the water quality not only in the aquifer but also in the Deschutes. So this is a priority for us. We think it's a good bill. We look forward to seeing the amendments, and we support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Tracy.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tracy Rutten with the League of Oregon Cities. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today testifying very enthusiastically in support of this bill. I want to thank DEQ for the many conversations they've had with us in touching base on this as they've continued down the path of drafting the language. And also want to thank Senator Roblin for the efforts that he's put into this issue, as well as Representative McEwen for her thoughtful contributions to the bill so far. This issue has obviously been around for a very long time, and it's one that's been on the radar of the municipal water providers and wastewater providers that we represent, but really became something that they were focusing a lot of their effort on during 2014 as we began to set our legislative priorities for the League. And the way that that process works for the League is really that we have a variety of different policy committees. The committee that I'm involved with is our Water Wastewater Committee. We had some conversation with DEQ at the time, and the committee did adopt this as one of their priorities, which was then forwarded on to our general membership, all 242 cities, as a ballot that contained 22 priorities. And while it's unfortunate to say it didn't make it to the top five priorities, it was very, very close. And I think the thing was that was most interesting to me was the variety of folks who indicated this as one of their top priorities, which were about 20 of our cities who had that as one of their top issues, and the variety of locations and the size of the communities. It was varied all across the state, and really both urban, more rural types of communities. It was across the board. So it is an issue. I do appreciate what Doug just mentioned in that it looks different in different areas of the state, which is why we appreciate some of the flexibility of the program. We are recently dealing with an issue that was out in Milton Freewater and that Senator Hansel has been engaged in trying to work through, where some folks that are outside the city limits were having issues with failing septic systems and wanted to be annexed into the city. The problem being that they are miles and miles away and through several orchards from the city limits. These folks are having significant public health issues related to that failure of those systems and use something called a health hazard annexation process to try and get into the city. It's been challenging because that process, they didn't realize, also includes some costs for extending the services out from the city. But they really don't have a lot of options. And so we see this, while city services might not be appropriate to address that, this type of program might be another avenue that folks like that can pursue, which we support greatly. So I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your time.
Question?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Sean, you would probably understand that if one of these loans was not paid back, it would be on the mortgage and would be paid back then. I just want to make that point. The problem with, like in Milton Freewater, those people probably are not going to meet the threshold of low and low income to be able to qualify for this. So they're still going to be in some kind of dilemma. That's my assumption.
Chair Edwards, correct, Senator Olson, my understanding, and I don't know personally the income levels, so could get more information around that if we have it, but my understanding is that these are folks that are in an area that I would imagine they very well might apply.
Okay, thank you. Follow up?
Yeah.
This is a good program. The question I would have is how big will it get? You know, $4 million to start with, we need to hold back 10% for loan failures, so that's $400,000. We've got hundreds of thousands of systems. 10 to 20% of those are failing. This could be a $20 to $30 to $50 million event. Are we prepared for that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I think you're correct that the level of potential septic failure is going to greatly outgrow this limited $4 million fund. I do know that we've looked at other states, and Washington was one that was referenced earlier, where this has kind of been a basis for a program that generates other interest and support from foundations, environmental groups, et cetera. So I really view this as being a small piece of the puzzle. The other thing is I think this is a pilot project. So if it works, we can always come back in the next session and say it's done well, it needs to be improved here, it needs more funding there, and then the Ways and Means Committee can make a determination. But I certainly agree that the cost of fixing every septic system in Oregon, probably in Deschutes County, would probably far outweigh $4 million. But what this does get is a partnership, and not every loan will be for the full amount. So my guess is that if I'm structuring a loan program, I'm going to say, well, you can afford to pay $10,000, you can't afford $15,000, I'll loan you $15,000, or you can afford $20,000 but not $5,000, and I'll loan you $5,000, or maybe we can connect you to a city sewer that's four blocks away, and that'll cost you $8,000. So it's possible that we can be flexible.
Four blocks would be a little more than eight. It's probably about $100,000.
Well, it could be right.
$100,000.
It's downhill.
So, I would say this is a good program, but the fact is that it's going to get expensive. It probably will work. It's going to get expensive. I probably will support this through the process.
Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, again, for the record, Sean Cleave representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. And I completely understand your reservations regarding the scope of the project. You know, from our perspective, obviously there would be a lien potentially attached to the property. But the other solution for going after solving this problem, which you so eloquently stated in all of its vastness, would be a point of sale mandate, which, given the value of some of these properties, would completely mitigate any value in the purchase price. So that's where our greater concern lies. I think Mr. Riggs laid out some of the opportunities for that public-private partnership, which we would definitely support. And I completely agree. I think it's just a small piece of the puzzle, but a good approach with a reasonable concept.
I do have one follow-up.
One follow-up.
Sean, you just mentioned the lien. Do you think that lenders will be reticent to allow a second encumbrance on the property, or do you think the mortgage holders would be more than willing to say, yeah, go ahead and borrow this money on that?
Well, I'd have to look at the demographic within what had occurred in the pilot project. It might be something we'd look at in hindsight, or maybe look to Washington to see how their program runs. My assumption would be that due to a targeted demographic of lower income people, they're not as mobile. They live in their properties for a longer period of time, so a low interest loan program would give them the flexibility to pay that off at the point of transition of the property. Again, that's my assumption. It's my hope based on the targeting.
But the question was, will the primary mortgage holder be amiable to a second encumbrance on the property?
Well, of course not. Whenever there's an encumbrance on the property, that it adds complexity to the transaction. But I think that's probably hopefully not a big factor in the program if it were to move forward, but a concern nonetheless, and one we'd look for.
Maybe we'll take a look at that.
It seems like if it's voluntary, the need well exceeds the ability of this stage one of the program. By stage one, I don't mean that it would change at all in the future, but it's hard for me. I spent 5 years on Ways and Means. It's hard for me not to think about it in those terms. $4 million is a big percent, at least historically. $4 million has been a big percent of what that little subcommittee down there has to work with. So I just would be thinking about, you've asked for four. They'll make the decision. If we pass it out of here and it goes to Ways and Means, they'll make the decision whether or not to fund it at all. But I would be thinking about ways to ensure that the fund is stable and solvent, because people don't want to be dealing with a failed program. And it's easy to come and support something that has all sorts of benefits, environmental, health, economic for the homeowners, benefits when it's a general fund. If we were proposing to fund this out of a real estate transfer tax or something, it'd be a completely different system.
Unconstitutional.
I'm just saying, it's general fund, so everybody's lining up. But just making a point that there are limitations to the general fund capabilities of this state. Tracy.
Chair Edwards, if I may, and just reminding the committee of the significant amount of investment that this state, including local governments as well, make in improvements to water quality. And we're talking millions upon millions of dollars in that arena. The area we really haven't been able to get to, one area I would identify as that's been really challenging to get to, is in the septic issues that we have as a state. And so I know it is a very small drop in the bucket in terms of the overall need, but we've got, I think, some good directions in looking at some innovations in water quality and looking at data and trends around those things. And I think that this kind of does complement those efforts, and just would remind you of the amount of money that we all have spent in making those improvements and what it costs us when we see waterways that are listed.
Good. Sure.
Yeah,
then we need to move on. Since I heard that there might be some amendments to this bill, maybe Senator Roblin and I can get together with some banking lobbyists to see if there would be any problem with encumbrances. Thank you.
Parting shot. You wanted to say something.
I'm fine. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, guys.
Duck cake.
Okay, next up, Mark Landauer, Peggy Lynch, Ken Yates. And Eric Kanzler will be after that, and that's all the people that are signed up for this bill.
Go ahead. Good afternoon, okay. Chair Edwards, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association. I have a meeting with one of your colleagues in 3 minutes, so I'll try to keep this to one. The Special Districts Association is very supportive of this measure. Obviously, we've spoken quite a bit about some changes that we will hope you get to review here shortly. I'd also like to thank Representative McEwen for her work on this. Needless to say, our interest is not only ensuring that families have access to affordable means to addressing their septic problems, but it will also help our districts protect not only water that is on the surface, but needless to say, also groundwater. We are also very supportive of the ability to hook up. It just doesn't seem to make sense to fix a septic system that in a very short period of time will have access to publicly owned treatment work system, so we're very supportive of that measure. I just note Ms. Rutten made a couple comments. We have source water providers, or we have potable water providers, that actually use some of their money in order to help upstream septic users get their septic systems fixed. It is more expensive to treat raw water that has been contaminated with byproducts of these systems than it is to fix these systems. So from our standpoint, this is an excellent investment in a very, very difficult problem to get to. The problem is big, but the way this bill is being structured, we're hopeful that we can get at some of those health benefits that really are important for many of my clients. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks.
Thank you. And if you'll excuse me.
Yeah, Mark's got to go, yeah. So if you don't, you're okay? Okay. Brian?
Senator Edwards, members of the committee, no, I'm not Ken Yates, though we do share the same hairline and a bit of a client base, but I'm here today on behalf of the Plumbing Mechanical Contractors Association, and there's been much said about this. It is a public health and safety issue, an environmental issue. A few of our contractors deal with some of this issue, more of them that are out in you know, smaller communities, because people are looking for, you know, who is going to help me on this. And it is a challenge, and the cost factors are rather high for some folks out there, and so a program like this would be a help out there, and it would be a much better answer for some of our contractors to be able to say, yeah, we can point you to some folks and might be able to get you some help here on it. So thank you.
And your name?
Brian Krieg, for the record. Yes.
Sorry.
Did you not say that?
No.
I think I did.
You're not Doug Yates.
That's what he said. He wasn't Doug Yates. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So the League has been involved in water issues and water quality issues for a long, long time. And I'm going to give you some minimal statistics. In our July of 2012 coastal study, Dune City adopted a septic ordinance in 2006 and again in 2010. And during the time the ordinances were in effect, 69% of the septic systems underwent some inspection because it was a required inspection. Of these, 12% had failed systems. So that's a specific set of information. The reason it was so important is because they get their source drinking water directly from Wohink, Clearwalks, and Silcoos Lakes. So it was extremely important that they get their drinking water system fixed. In 2013, as we testified on the bill that we've now talked about, it that at least allows when a time of sale people to know that they actually have a septic system that they might need to deal with. 70% of Oregonians, including over 90% of rural residents, rely on groundwater as their primary or secondary drinking source. So that's really important as we deal with the septic systems. In the McKenzie River, a total of 439 septic systems were inspected, of which 108 required pump outs. And Senator Olson, that's exactly part of what you said, is that that may be a beginning solution, is education and making sure that we get the pump outs. 55 systems needed significant repairs or replacement. So
we do have statistics. We do know that it's important. The Coos County League convened members of the Lakeside area to try to have a discussion on this issue. The Deschutes County League convened a meeting to talk about the Lapine issue. So we understand that it's a broad issue. I appreciated Mr. Landauer's comment about the cost of doing nothing. And how important it is to look at this cost related to the cost of doing nothing and TMDLs. Other than that, I think I will answer any questions. Sure. But we do support Thank this, you. And we're looking forward to the amendments.
Great.
You're a busy woman.
Pardon?
You are a busy woman.
Retirement's fun, Senator Olson.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And finally, Eric Kanzler, and anybody else that would like to testify on this bill that didn't sign up on the sheet, please feel free to come on forward. Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Kanzler representing the city of Bend. We've submitted written comments, so I'll be brief. We're very supportive of the bill. We're very supportive of the funding request and the legislature's interest in this issue. In the early 90s, Bend annexed about 2,500 homes in the southeast part of town, pretty much all at the same time. They were built in the 70s and the 80s, almost entirely on septic systems. And so we're sort of in the midst of a huge batch of ongoing failures. It's an issue of tremendous cost to the city, obviously. As you've heard, it's an issue of tremendous cost to the homeowners. I've heard of some situations where a hookup is worth about a quarter of the value of a home, $50,000 in some cases. I know that sounds extreme, but we've had at least a few of those instances. So this issue has forced the city to take on, use considerable financial resources that we would otherwise be devoting to system-wide connectivity, system-wide capacity. We've been forced to take on debt to address this issue. Frankly, I'm not sure we could responsibly take on any more debt than we already have. And given the fact that limitations of what homeowners handle are very real, we're really sort of at the edge of what we can do and looking at a very long-term problem. So a state program that addresses this need and that both offers funding for sewer hookups where those are appropriate and septic repair and replacement where those are appropriate, because we really have both needs inside the UGB. That's something that would be of enormous help to us. We've been part of the stakeholder discussions on this issue. We've been very impressed with the clear, uniform policy direction that people seem to want out of this. We're very appreciative of Senator Roblin's efforts, Representative McEwen's efforts, the agency's efforts, the efforts of everyone involved, and we would strongly encourage your support for moving this bill on. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric, any questions?
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so going once, going twice. Anybody else on Senate Bill 246? Seeing nobody, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 246. And next, we're going to, let's see. Next, we're going to go to Senate Bill 256. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 256. And Beth, could you explain what's happening? And while she's explaining that, if Lisa Hansen and Elizabeth Remley could come forward.
Senate Bill 256 authorizes the Oregon Department of Agriculture to adopt certification standards for persons dealing in nursery stocks, increases the maximum licensing fee for those growers from $20,000 to $25,000, and the maximum millage rate as well, and then increases the amount of the annual license fee for growers of Christmas trees. From $75 to $110 for the basic charge, and from $3 to $450 per acre.
Lisa, you want to start us off here?
Thank you, Chair Edwards. For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. Senate Bill 256 is a bill brought forward by the agency. It supports our nursery and Christmas tree program within ODA. And you may or may not be aware, but the nursery and Christmas tree program are significant within the department. We license, inspect, and provide certification that allows these products to ship all over the U.S. as well as internationally. We license about 3,200 nurseries and about 560 Christmas tree growers in this state. And last year, we issued about 7,500 certificates for shipment. Those would be phytosanitary certificates that look for pest and disease issues. And that really is the core of what this program does. It assures that nursery and Christmas trees that are shipped are pest and disease free. Senate Bill 256 has four major components. The first one is it would allow ODA to adopt new systems-based certification programs. There are many of these that are being developed nationally and in other states where they use more documentation by the growers. And so they're doing a larger portion of the work. The agency can audit. It allows efficiencies in terms of the agency's inspection program as well. Second, the bill provides specific authority for ODA to revoke shipping permits should a producer ship product outside of what it should, or if the product is dirty and rejected and it was not supposed to be shipped, simply. And then third, it increases the license and millage tax on nurseries, and it increases the license and millage tax on Christmas trees. ODA has license schedules that we adopt in rule to cover the costs of these programs, and we work with the industry very closely to evaluate the revenues and expenses of the programs and evaluate the programs and service delivery whenever we have to set these fees to cover those costs. So with that, I'll pause, and maybe Elizabeth can talk about the nursery industry a little bit.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of Oregon Association of Nurseries. I know that you have testimony that says that I'm Jeff Stone. I assure you that I am not Jeff Stone, but he says hello.
We figured that out.
The nursery industry in Oregon is the largest agricultural sector in the state. They have 766, more than pears. I'm sorry, right. Senator Thompson. They have $766 million in sales in Oregon every year. They are bouncing back pretty strongly from the recession, and the industry is growing again, which is really good news. 75% of what's grown in Oregon in the nursery industry is shipped out of the state, and ODA's program of licensure and inspection helps us ensure that those shipments are clean, pest and disease-free, and really, really good quality stock for wherever it's going, either to the East Coast or internationally. We really appreciate everything that the Department of Ag does for the nursery industry. The ODA's program here in Oregon is well respected around the nation. Jeff hears every day from his counterparts in other states about the program and the relationship that we have with the Department of Agriculture here in Oregon. And I think that it's a good model for how to do the nursery industry right. And we really appreciate their willingness to work with us to update our statutes. We're interested in allowing them to have more authority to revoke licenses so that when a nursery ships dirty stock, they can be that can be swiftly dealt with. Right now, it's more of a loose-based system, and I think that it's important to tighten that up. And the big and most important piece for us, too, is this increase in the caps for millage and licensing fees. We're bumping up against that right now. We need to increase it. We want to work with the Department of Ag, at least on the nursery side, to do more frequent and smaller increases rather than big jumps every 10 years. And so we're looking forward to establishing a process for doing that on a consistent basis and rule. And I don't know, I'll take any questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, Senator Thompson.
Yeah, just if somebody is suspended for sending out something that they shouldn't be sending out, what's the policy to get reinstated? I mean, is it a year-long suspension? I mean, I don't know the process, so how does that work?
It's 3 years.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, I looked back to our expert who's in the back to make sure I answered this question. We don't have a policy right now. It's very difficult to do that. And so, you know, this authority would allow us to establish that and have very clear specifications.
Follow up?
Another question, I think. So when you're working with nurseries, you can set your fee rates. We won't have to raise your fees. You can do that, is what you were saying, by the setting the standard higher. So then we can blame you if the fees get increased? Is that how I heard that?
Senator Edwards, Senator Thompson. So the way this program works is there is a cap in statute, which is a maximum amount that can be charged for a license fee. We have a tiered fee schedule based on gross sales with a millage tax that's added on to that. We adjust that through administrative rule, working with the industry to cover the costs. When we adjust those through administrative rule, they then come back for ratification in an agency fee bill that works through the Ways and Means process. Right. So you get to look at it either way.
All right. Okay. Thought they have some new system. We get blamed.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you. In the bill, you wanted to raise the fee to no more than $25,000, but I got a letter saying that we'd like to go to $40,000. Can you relate why $40,000 would be a good number rather than $25,000?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, there is an amendment that we have requested. We don't have it back yet that would increase the cap to $40,000. So it's not, we don't expect that every license will be $40,000 in next year. And if it is, don't worry, Senator Thompson, we'll come tell you about it. We think that $25,000, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's is it the current cap?
The current cap is
so the current cap is $20,000. It would only, the bill as written would only increase it to $25,000, which means we'd have to come back in just a couple of years to get it raised again. We'd prefer to have it increased by a larger amount now and then work with the Department of Ag over the years to get to do the smaller increases so that we don't have to come back and change our statute again in 2 or 4 years.
Follow-up?
Yeah.
What size nursery, dollar-wise or volume-wise, would it take to meet that $25,000 or $40,000 cap?
Do you know the answer to that?
So I'm looking.
So there's a, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, there's a fee schedule that the Department of Ag submitted that would show you kind of the different levels of fees, and Lisa might be able to.
Yep. So I'll just walk you through one of the fee schedules. And so this is a fee schedule for nursery license for nursery stock growers and collectors of native plants. So if that type of license had sales from $0 to $20,000, it would be $129. If the sales were $20,000 to $100,000, it would be $129 plus a millage tax, which is the sales times the 0.004. Sales of $100,000 to $200,000 have a base of $449 plus a millage tax of 0.0037, and then 200 to 500 have a base of 819 plus a millage tax of 0.003. Sales of 500,000 to 2 million have a base of $1,719 plus a millage tax of 0.0018. And nurseries with over $2 million worth of sales have a base of $4,419 plus the millage tax.
It seems like the millage tax gets smaller the higher up you go the ladder.
Yeah.
I guess where I'm going to is they're your members. Are they going to like that $15,000 bump?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we don't expect that any licensing fee will go up by $15,000 over a year. We're anticipating that with the economy getting better and our industry coming back from a recession and sales growing, that we're going to get to a place where these nurseries are going to get bigger than the current fee schedule, and the fees that they're paying to the Department of Ag won't cover the services, the inspection, and other programs that the Department of Ag returns to the industry. And so we want to make sure that as the economy is really good and we have great sales and we're doing really well, that the Department of Ag can keep up with us.
That'd be about, 2030, 2040?
Senator Thompson.
I understand. Thank you.
Just in response to Senator Olson, don't worry, Senator Olson. We'll get blamed for it. They will. The nurseries won't. Don't worry.
Chair Edwards, if I might add, one of the things that's an important part of the discussion that's been going on with the nursery industry is we're talking with them about really doing an annual review of the finances in this program and looking at possibly some annual cost inflation factor. So there's smaller incremental increases over time.
Lisa, do you inspect all crops that go out of state?
Think about this. So, Mr. Chair, Senator.
And by crops, I mean nursery stock. Yeah.
We would issue phytosanitary certificates for those nursery crops going out of state. They would be federal phytosanitary certificates. I think they're all issued by our program, with the exception I can think of in the fruit and vegetable program where USDA issues those.
But do you inspect all? Do you send somebody out to look at the?
Gary, why don't you come on forward and talk about what you do? So I'm going to let, I'll let Gary McInnich, who's a programming manager, talk just quickly
about
that.
Sorry about that, sir. I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. For the record, my name is Gary McInnich. I am the program manager for the Nursery and Christmas Tree Program at the Department of Agriculture. Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, we inspect each licensed nursery annually. At least that's our intent. We get most of them annually for inspect the general cleanliness of the stock there, and then many of the shipments that moved out of state, we look at the individual shipments to ensure they don't contain dangerous pests and diseases.
Kind of like Christmas season, you're out there looking at all the trees going.
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, we do the Christmas trees also. So that's kind of another part of the bill is inspection of Christmas trees that leave the state, and we do. We inspect quite a few of those, millions of
but
them.
But not all?
Not all.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you all for being here and for your testimony. I don't have anybody else signed up for Senate Bill 256. Anybody else want to testify on 256? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 256, and we are going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 248. Beth, if you could tell us what's happening here, and do we have the department here to, a couple, Liz Dent and Ed DeBlander from the Department of Forestry. I apologize if I did not pronounce your name right.
That's perfect.
Senate Bill 248 authorizes the state forester to enter into and administer contracts for activities necessary or convenient for sale of timber from lands owned or managed by the State Board of Forestry. Forestry Department.
Okay.
All right.
Great. Thank you. For the record, my name is Liz Dent, and I'm the Division Chief for State Forests within the Oregon Department of Forestry. Chair Edwards and members of the committee, I appreciate the chance to testify on our bill, Senate Bill 248, and at its basic level, this bill is intended to help increase the revenue to the State Forest Division within the Oregon Department of Forestry. By way of a little bit of background, ODF manages approximately 830,000 acres statewide. The department's program is self-funded, primarily through the sale of timber. And in 2009, we saw a severe decline in our ability to cover our management costs, and clearly that was related to the recession in 2009. So we identified this problem and have continued to work on it, but currently the division does not generate enough revenue to cover our management costs and to provide adequate revenue to our beneficiaries, namely the counties and Common School Fund. So given this situation, the Board of Forestry directed the Department of Forestry to examine opportunities to improve our business practices as a way to increase our revenue and thus improve on our financial viability. So the intent, again, of Senate Bill 248 is to support the financial viability goal by clarifying the Oregon Department of Forestry's current authority on how to market and sell timber off of state forest land. This approach, as proposed in the bill, would increase efficiencies and the revenue that is generated from the sale of timber off of state forests. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Ed DeBlander, who is our asset unit manager, and allow him to get into some of the more details of the bill.
Great. Thanks, Liz. Chair Edwards, committee members, for the record, my name is Ed DeBlander. I'm the asset manager for the Oregon Department of Forestry's State Forest Division. The current situation for us is that ORS 530 authorizes the state forester to enter into and administer contracts for the sale of timber from lands owned and managed by the Department of Forestry. In addition, ORS 279A exempts these contracts from public contracting laws. This exemption was established during the 1995 legislative session with the passage of Senate Bill 749. And Bill 749 received broad support and no opposition. This proposed bill, Senate Bill 248, clarifies Department of Forestry's timber sale authority to include alternative methods for the sale of timber and extends the existing exemption to include these alternative methods. So under the current method of selling timber from state forests, a single purchaser will buy standing trees in the sale area and is responsible for all of the harvesting and hauling and then the project work associated with the sale. Currently, the Oregon Department of Forestry includes all activities necessary or convenient for the sale of timber as part of one overarching timber sale contract. Alternatives to this approach have been identified as a way to increase revenues to both the agency and the beneficiaries that Liz mentioned earlier. Senate Bill 248 explicitly clarifies Oregon Department of Forestry's authority to enter into and administer individual contracts separately from the sale of timber. Individual contracts include, but are not necessarily limited to, activities such as the harvesting, sorting, and transporting of the logs, gravel pit development and operation, and road construction, maintenance, or improvement. ODF envisions two new business practices for ODF, but are fairly very common practices within the industry that Senate Bill 248 will make possible. The first of those is selling delivered log sorts rather than standing timber. This would require ODF to hire the logger to harvest and deliver the logs and to contract for the construction of the roads. The other business practice that we can envision is for ODF to begin, for some sales, constructing the roads under contract prior to selling our standard stumpage sales the way we do today. Road construction requirements in our current timber sales frequently delays the purchaser's ability to harvest, to start harvest activities for up to a year. This can increase the purchaser's risk on their bid and can delay the flow of revenue to stakeholders and to ODF. The common barrier to implementing these strategies is the public contracting code requirement to pay prevailing wages on road construction contracts greater than or equal to $50,000. This requirement will increase the cost of these projects by an estimated 25% to 30% and would likely negate any marginal gains from the business practices. I want to make one last point. The work performed under the separate contracts that we're envisioning is exactly the same as the work performed under our current timber sale contracts. And the activities that are exempt under current timber sales are the same as those activities that would occur under the separate contracts. SB 248 would clarify that the exemption applies under this alternative method. So, Liz?
So, yeah, just a few closing remarks, and again to emphasize that we really see this as providing a useful tool in the toolbox that, again, would help address our financial viability problem on state forests, truthfully, incrementally, but definitely one mechanism to help us, again, to increase revenue and improve business practices. This will result in improved efficiencies as well that allow us to remain solvent and to support the needs of our beneficiaries. And along those lines, you have some testimony from the Association of Oregon Counties and the County Forest Trust Lands Committee in support of this bill. So with that, I would entertain any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for you, Ed. So just to confirm what I think you said, with respect to the prevailing wage issue, this would not be restricting the use of prevailing wage, since prevailing wage doesn't apply currently, right?
That's correct.
So people who are currently getting paid prevailing wage will not lose that wage rate.
Yes, Senator Edwards, Senator Dembrough, that is correct. There would be no change in that.
And have you heard any objection from the entities that would be doing that prevailing wage work about this? Any concern from them?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembrough, we have not been aware of any concerns about that.
Thank you.
Okay, I need a clarification. What I thought you said and then what Senator Dembrough confirmed were two different things. So could you explain to me again how prevailing wage pertains to this bill? Because I believe you said the largest obstacle that you have is the requirement to pay prevailing wage on these activities if you were to engage in these activities.
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembrough, so that is correct. The current situation is that when our timber sale purchasers who are currently responsible for road construction projects prior to starting harvesting, those timber sale contracts that we put out are exempt from the public contracting rules, which is where the prevailing wage is.
That makes it clear for me.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Questions?
Nope.
Okay.
Yep. Just to put on the record some testimony that's written that we've got in our file. One gentleman or person said that you could increase your income by 40% to 50% if you would start logging a little bit more. So I just wanted to point that out. But secondly, a couple people have written in and they're concerned about your ability to handle the mining and construction of roads, because as we talked about in my office, you're going to become a general contractor and you're going to hire different people to do this. So are you going to rely on their expertise to know about mining and aggregate removal and place and fill?
So Senator Edwards, Senator Olson, so we currently have that expertise on all of our districts. So within our timber sale contracts, you could almost look as the portions that deal with rock pit development and operation and the road construction. We have road engineers that write those portions of the contract already. So this is really what the current situation is, a little more awkward and indirect, because even though the purchaser hires the road builder, it's our engineers, road engineers, that are out there overseeing that the contract is being done correctly. So this would be a more direct relationship between the contractor and the ODF contract administrator.
Well, I knew the answer to that question because I asked it in my office, and I wanted to get it on the record that you have the expertise to do this.
Yes.
The only other question I would have is, as far as permitting goes, would you be able to, do you have to go through the same permit process that any Joe off the street does, or are you going to be exempt from some of these permits that you might have had to get?
So I think, Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I believe we are required to get the same permits. I assume you're talking about the Forest Practices Act and those kinds of things.
And going over streams and all of that stuff.
Absolutely, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you both for being here and answering our questions. So we've got next up, I'm going to call up Bob and Kirk Luoto and Rex Storm.
Don't forget the gentleman that was signed up on.
Yeah, I got it. And then next up will be Bob Soden. And that's all we have signed up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we are Bob and Kirk Luoto. We're owners of Cross and Crown, Inc., a logging and trucking company located in Carlton, Oregon. We represent the third and fourth generation of owners in our family business. We are here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 248 relating to the sale of timber from the state forest lands. Quite simply put, Senate Bill 248 would authorize a new way for the Oregon Department of Forestry to market its timber. Traditionally, the state sells its timber to the highest bidder, who then hires a contractor, such as ourselves, to log the sale and deliver the logs to a designated mill location. Under this model, the contractor works for the business entity that buys the sale. What Senate Bill 248 would do is modify the status and regulations to allow the state to maintain ownership of the timber, hire the contractor directly, and market the logs to milling facilities with the objective of maximizing revenues to the state.
We're sharing this. We refer to this model.
If you could state your name for the record.
My name is Kirk Luoto.
Thank you.
We refer to this model in the industry as a log sort timber sales. The logs most suitable for manufacturing lumber would be sold by the state to a sawmill. The logs most suitable for making plywood would be sold to a plywood mill. The logs meeting the specs for poles would be sold to a pole yard. Pulpwood would end up in the chipping facility, etc. These sale arrangements and delivery destinations would be determined in advance of the logging. The objective is to maximize the return to the state by delivering each log to its destination where the most value can be realized. Our company has experience with these types of sales and believe that they can improve financial returns to the state in the proper circumstances and with the proper oversight by the Department of Forestry. Now, we would be remiss if we didn't remind the committee that the best and most efficient way for the Department of Forestry to improve state forest financially, financial performance would be to sell more timber. We believe our state forest lands are an underperforming asset because the state is not currently selling near the volume these lands have the potential to grow. In fact, the harvest levels on the Tillamook and Clatsop state forests could be increased by 40% to 50% on a sustained yield basis while protecting other resources as required by the Oregon Forest Practices Act. We would encourage the committee to take a look at this issue if the state is seriously interested in improving the financial performance of these most valuable assets.
And in conclusion, we support Senate Bill 248 for the following reasons. Number one, the bill would give the Department of Forestry a new tool in its toolbox. Number two, while we are not suggesting a wholesale change to the log sort sales, we support the bill adding another useful tool to help market some state forest timber for financial returns to the counties, taxing districts, and the Department of Forestry. The bill would provide, number three, the bill would provide contractors such as our company the opportunity to work directly for the state without being encumbered with many of the complicated and sometimes convoluted contracting requirements the state employs for direct contracting. Number four, we believe this bill would also improve the revenues received on those select timber sales where a log sort transaction model makes sense. We'd be prepared to take questions after everybody testifies or whatever.
Yeah, we'll move first to Rex and then open up for questions.
Chair Edwards and committee members, my name is Rex Storm. I'm a forest policy manager for Associated Oregon Loggers based here in Salem. We're the statewide trade group representing 1,000 forest contract companies, which are engaged in operations including harvest and construction and timber purchase. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 248 as the bill does clarify and add an additional method that would be useful for the Department of Forestry to sell timber from state forest timberlands. This additional method, referred to as the log sort sales, could help foster improved revenue production for the counties, taxing districts, and the department. We support the purpose of the bill and for the several reasons. First of all, authorization of log sort sales of timber from state forests would be a market benefit for the small business forest contractors that we represent. The addition of this sort sale option offers more opportunities for forest contractors, as the Oregon Department of Forestry would then become an additional customer offering to hire the contractor's services. Next, the Oregon State Forest Timber sale program has a proven track record of successful exemption from the burden of the public contracting code. This exemption should be extended to those individual activities proposed by this bill. Next, the state forester is indeed qualified, capable, and willing to accept this new log sort authorization to contract for those specific activities necessary for the total sale of timber from state forests. And lastly, while the bill could potentially make incremental increases in the revenue received from the sale of timber sold by the log sort method, ultimately the greatest means to improve revenues from state forests would be increased timber sale volumes. In closing, we would support passage of this bill, and thank you for your consideration, and I could answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Rex. And Bob and Kirk, questions?
I have one.
Yeah.
It was your paper that I took. Sorry about that. I do have a question for you. And like you have a mixed lot selection of trees, and your company can particularly go in and take out everything that's in there. How about if it's a selective sale where somebody buys those timber trees, the wood trees, the other ones buy the plywood trees, and somebody else buys maybe some hardwoods that were in there? Would the first guy in affect the ability of the other guys to come in behind to get their product out? Would it affect their marketability or the cost to the second and third down the line getting the trees? Or would Department of Forestry provide some kind of who goes first kind of deal? I know it's kind of a dumb question, but I started
thinking about... I'm going to explain a little bit about how...
Oh, okay. Yeah, I try to think about
sales work
three or different kind of trees in there.
Senator Olson, I think I know what you're getting at. And basically what we do as contractors is when we take on a sale, we will do the state bids out the different sorts, different species, plywood, poles, alder, hardwoods, pulp. That's all bid separately. They have that decided before we go into the sale. So what our job to do, even if it's a partial cut or whatever, is to sort those sales out on our landings, our area where we take the wood to and generally put it on a truck. So that's what we do, and then we do that for the state. We also do it for the mills, other mills that we work for. So it's nothing out of the realm of what we do generally as a contractor.
Well, I follow up. Yeah. I guess my question is like you go in and you bid on the hardwoods and you get that bid, but somebody else bids on the poles and they get that bid. So how would you coordinate that work effort so that when you drop your hardwoods or drop your big fir trees, that you don't hurt the value of the poles that are standing in proximity to the big firs? I mean, how would that be coordinated? So I'm just trying to figure out how it all works.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, so what we would do is a lot of it is all pre-planning by the Department of Forestry. Like you said, if there was a pole stand, if it's a transmission pole and it's a highly sensitive material, we would typically go in and harvest that first and get their material out. And then we would go back in afterwards and final harvest.
How about if somebody overbid you for the poles and it's their poles? And then
we are the contract loggers, and so all we would do is we just deliver that to them. So we will take it from the stump.
I got you.
Log it, process it, make sure that it fits their specs, and then we have our own trucks and we haul it in. I know we're dressed up, but we're just loggers.
Well, I guess I'm kind of thinking of Axeman, and they had two of those riggings right next to each other. I just wondered, obviously now, that you guys would go in and do all of the work and take out what you needed. As you need. Yeah. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Olson, please don't ever believe Axeman. I mean, it's not.
I'm a follower.
That's so, not how it's done.
I have a question for you, and maybe this is more a question for the department. Head nods are fine, but would this create a system? Would this authority create a system in which you would not have to put a sale out for bid? No. Okay. So everything would still be bid out, and everybody in the geography, in the wood basket, whatever you want to call it, is able to bid on it still, and winning bidders or bidders get the wood, and this doesn't change any sort of contracting authority that would allow you just to have long-term contracts with one particular mill, nothing like that.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, that leads me to a question again. You're looking at three different kinds of material in a log stand. So the Forest Service is selling it, right? And if you get bidders that bid on the fir and you get bidders that bid on the maple or the walnut or whatever, could they be three different bidders? Would they be three different bidders? But then they'd hire you to come in and take it all out.
Yes.
Yeah. Chairman Edwards and Senator Olson, yes, they would. They have, there could be, I think in our sort, there's probably up to 8 or 10 different sorts, and they've had, we bid out our particular logging project. We do the project ourselves. We bid that out to get the wood to the landing and to the sorts. They bid out all the sorts. The Department of Forestry takes and bids out all the sorts to all the mills and puts in there certain parameters that the sorts are in, and then we will do that, put that all together. So it's all basically we're bidding against anybody that wants to bid, and then we get the bid, and then they do the same thing. So it's basically under public bid. I hope that answers that question.
It does,
Senator Olson. Thank you.
Any other questions?
I'm still confused.
Thank you, all of you, for being here and testifying.
Thank you for having us.
And next we're going to call up Bob Soden, and then that's all that's signed up. If there's anybody else that's interested in testifying on this bill, please come on up now. Looks like this is the last panel. Go ahead, Bob.
For the record, I'm Bob Soden, Cottage Grove, Chair Edwards, Senator Brzozinski, and committee members. I'm here as an analyst for the Oregon Citizens Lobby, representing an advisor that is in the sand and gravel business that has concerns regarding SB 48 being opposed to the wording that was added in the existing statute. SB 248 authorizes the state forester to enter into contracts for the sale of timber that includes gravel pit development and operations. The Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, DOGAMI, already regulates all mining in the state of Oregon. The concern is the wording that includes development and operations. The state forester has no real-world experience in regulating the development and operation of a gravel pit. The state forester should be involved in the contract in dealing with the sale and harvesting and transportation of trees. The development and operations of the gravel pit should be left to DOGAMI. The statute already includes the administration of contracts for the sale of timber. Where more regulation has unintended consequences for Oregon businesses, as the majority of mines in the state are aggregate mines, a main ingredient in concrete and asphalt pavement, diatomaceous earth is another material that have commercial uses. The total annual aggregate production in Oregon is approximately 52 million cubic yards. And I thank you for taking into consideration the concerns of the sand and gravel operations in Oregon.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions for Mr. Soden? You look like you had a question. No.
I don't really have a question, but you know, the way I read what the bill says about gravel pit development or operation, that's in the context of the road building, right? And they would still need, I think, the permit from DOGAMI.
Can we get clarification to have the department come up?
I was going to call him back up.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I talked to him personally. He was concerned because that's his business, that that they include the operations and the mm-hmm. development part.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. If we get the department back up here to speak to this particular concern.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paul Bell, Deputy Director for Oregon Department of Forestry. In regards to the rock pick question, the department does not sell rock commercially. This is all for the use of rock on the forest roads, and we have a silvicultural exemption from Dog Gammy in this. Also just had this conversation with Dog Gammy earlier in the day, too, just to be make sure we were real clear there. But that's the same for non-commercial rock pits on forest land.
Okay. Thank you. Is that...
Yeah, it sounds to me basically you're just moving rock that's on the site for road construction and building, and it's already been, let's call it, waived or preempted by a rule that Nogami says that this is permissible as long as it's within that context.
Chair Edwards, Senator Pozanski, I don't have the technical passage there as that passes through, and we'd be more than happy to get that to you. Those types of rock, those non-commercial rock pits on forest land don't fall under Dog Gammy authority.
Okay, but I guess the question is, Mr. Chair, if I can follow up. I mean, what I'm hearing is that there's some belief that the rock that we're talking about being moved is actually staying on the track in the sense of being used for road building. But now I'm hearing potentially that this rock isn't governed by Dog Gammy, and then the Forest Service, can you commercially move that and do anything with it? Or what are we doing with it besides building road?
Correct. Senator Edwards, Senator Pozanski, the rock is used just for the road construction,
okay.
Just for the forest roads.
Yeah, we just want to make sure that's on the record for everyone that's following, understands how it's used and it's not somehow being commercially
correct.
Marketed.
Right. Thank you. Thanks for the clarification, guys. Anybody else want to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 248, and I think that's all we have for the day, so we are adjourned.
Oh.
We are adjourned.
Oh.
That's all we have for the day, so